morning, we have before us 0709 in the matter of the definition of the practice of law and the administration of a rule defining the practice of law. As you all know, this has been before us before, in fact, a number of times. And we have a proposed court rule that was prepared for discussion and put on the court website, and we have also a revised draft by the State Bar of Wisconsin, which has been the petitioner. We have two presenters, the president of the bar and the chairman of the Unauthorized Practice of Law Policy Committee of the State Bar. And we have now signed up 11 people who wish to speak to the court. If you haven't signed up with the marshal, would you please do so? So I have an idea of how many people are signed up and how we should allocate our time. We'll begin with the presenters, President Kammer.
May it please the court, I'm really here to primarily make introductions. Tom Zilovy of the of our committee will be addressing the court on the merits. I do, however, want to make just a very brief comment. At tab 2 of your materials, you will see a photograph of a billboard that was taken in Washera County. And I hope that from time to time you'll look at that as you proceed. This is a paralegal who will offer family law, estate planning, real estate. She does pro se divorces and child visitation, wills, powers of attorney, quitclaim deeds and warranty deeds, handles child support, and so forth. What you're going to hear today is from other disciplines that are concerned about the petition as well as from the petition itself. The law is as vast as the entire human experience, so it's not surprising that white-collar people of all stripes bump into the law and overlap a little bit, from social workers to accountants to realtors on down the line. But if you look at tab 2 and look at this photograph, it will perhaps help you stay focused on the real problem, and that is the core problem, not the periphery, not these little overlaps on the sides, but the core problem. And the core problem is that we are facing an onslaught of lay practitioners. They're out there, they're overt, they're on the web, they're in the billboards, they're in the newspapers, they're everywhere. And it's a very serious problem. It's a problem for the public. It's a threat to the public that they will be putting their faith and their money in unqualified pseudo-professionals. With that, I introduce Mr. Tom Zilovy, who will be speaking on behalf of the State Bar.
Thank you, Mr. Dak Kammer. Attorney Zilovy.
May it please the court, my name is Tom Zilovy. I'm a member of the State Bar, and I'm currently chair of the State Bar's Unauthorized Practice of Law Policy Committee. And I'm here because everybody else is either in Florida or Arizona.
We could have held court there had you asked. We could have held court there had you asked.
You could, well. Okay, it's too late for that now.
Okay.
In any event, I have been involved in State Bar's relationship to the problem of the unauthorized practice of law in the state of Wisconsin for about 20 years. It began with what the State Bar used to call the Consumer Protection Committee, and that morphed into the Unauthorized Practice of Law Policy Committee. I don't think that there's any question but that what the bar wants is represented in its petition is a relatively straightforward rule which defines the practice of law. I think our profession is one of the few professions or service businesses in the state of Wisconsin that's regulated that does not have useful definition as to what it constitutes. We believe that the unauthorized practice of law that has persisted in Wisconsin for many years and which is increasing in quantity during the past few years is a significant social problem for consumers. And the bar believes that a definition of the practice of law and a relatively simple administrative system for enforcement of the rule will provide a method for protecting the consuming public from the problems created by the practice of law or the provision of legal advice and legal services by persons who are not subject to regulation by this court and who are not competent and able to provide legal services to the unsuspecting consumer. Before we devised our rule, we conferred with several organizations which we knew would have an interest in whatever we came up with for a definition of the practice of law. I believe all of those interests are represented here today, the realtors, the bankers, the insurance industry, and CPAs. We conferred with several representatives of those organizations or those businesses and industries before we devised our rule. We tried to take into account the concerns that those various interested parties had without watering down the purpose of the rule, which is to provide a vehicle for dealing with the unauthorized practice of law. Subsequent to filing the petition with the court with the proposed rule, we took into account some of the concerns of the various interested parties and have, over the past 3 years, modified the initial rule, which we had asked the court to adopt in our petition. And we now have what we call the fourth draft of the proposed rule, which we filed with the court several weeks ago. And the most recent changes that are represented in draft four pertain to some requests by the Indian Law Section of the State Bar and also by the benefit specialists who function, I think, under Chapter 48 of the Wisconsin statute. I think that we have demonstrated to the court through various submissions to it that there is a significant problem that consumers in Wisconsin face with the unauthorized practice of law. And we have devised a rule and a system for administering the rule which provides a method for dealing with those engaged in the unauthorized practice of law.
Let's talk about the system for a moment.
Pardon?
I want to talk to you about the system for administering this rule for a moment. The petition, as I understand it, asks that the OLR be the administrator or the BBE or that the court establish an independent, I shouldn't say independent, a third arm of the court relating to these issues. And I think you agree that the administrative system is perhaps as important or maybe more important than all the provisions, because the problem with the unauthorized practice law now is that it's administered by the district attorney, and that's low on the priority list. You agree that the administrative decision...
That's absolutely correct. I think in the last 20 years, I know of maybe two or three instances where a district attorney in Wisconsin has actually undertaken an investigation and some kind of prosecution under 757.30. But as a practical matter, the statute is useless with respect to dealing with the unauthorized practice of law problems.
Well, the Office of Lawyer Regulation regulates what one of our correspondents called APL, Authorized Practice of Law.
Right.
This regulates a totally different group of people, that is, people without a lawyer, a license. Your petition has figures from other states as to how much is spent for UPL, and they range from $1,500, if my memory is correct, to a lot more. What do you expect this to cost? The last time the bar thought it was $10 a lawyer. And if you had 20,000 lawyers all paying the full freight, which you don't, that would be $200,000 a year.
Right.
Then I should tell you, at present, the OLR assesses each lawyer in the state. It's not quite correct. New lawyers get assessed less, but essentially $147 a year. They're short money, and they're going to bring to the court, whether the court adopts it or not, a budget that's going to ask for another $17. It's going to be $164 per year for OLR. And that would, if you think $10 is the appropriate amount, that would bring it up to $174 a year. That's a large assessment, and it's creeping up in the year of the Great Recession, which has touched lawyers too, right?
That's correct.
Okay, so I have two issues. One, OLR, which is out of their bailiwick at the moment, regulating non-lawyers. BBE, which also just deals with lawyers or wannabe lawyers through the bar exam. It's not quite in their bailiwick. And yet another entity. And how much is that going to cost?
Okay, now let me address those questions. First of all, we created a proposed administrative system, which we think is quite simple. It is based largely on how the Wisconsin Department of Regulation and Licensing functions with respect to the oversight of other professions that operate in the state of Wisconsin. We think that the system that we're proposing by the proposed rule is quite simple and straightforward. We felt that the best place to locate the administrator of it, which we contemplate would be a half-time person, a single half-time person, would be in the office of OLR, primarily not to interfere with the function of OLR. And perhaps the objective of having a consumer office that deals with the unauthorized practice in OLR isn't quite similar to what OLR is charged to do. But we felt that we could share facilities. We would not detract in any way from the budgetary needs of OLR. It would not interfere with the operation of OLR, and that at times when the need for acting with respect to the unauthorized practice of law doesn't exist, that the services of that person, which would be paid for through an assessment of state bar members separately from OLR, could be used to assist the administration of OLR. We continue to think that is the most pragmatic place to place that position. We would like to avoid creating a separate entity, such as the one suggested in our last submission to the court, which we would call, let's say, a practice of law board. We do think that would be more expensive and more complicated, and if possible, we would like to avoid that. And again, we feel that the location of this office in OLR is the best and most pragmatic place to place it. Now, as far as cost is concerned, I think it's reasonable to extrapolate from the budget of the Bar Association of the State of Washington, which has a practice of law board system. Their budget for 2010 is around $184,000. $25,000 of that budget is allocated for the practice of law board itself. I assume that that budgetary allocation has to do with reimbursement for expenses and facilities for meetings and things like that. That organization has two half-time employees. One's an investigator and one's the administrator. We're talking about having one half-time person that would function in this area. Based on the experience of the Department of Regulation and Licensing, and one of our committee members, Jack Zweig, has worked for that department for years and has a great deal of experience in observing how that agency regulates other professions. Our committee, based on Mr. Zweig's input, thinks that we'll probably have somewhere between 15 and 25 incidents a year, at least starting out, that would have to be investigated and dealt with in some way. That's why we feel one half-time person can handle this. And we would contribute to the overhead expense at the OLR office. We feel that the overall cost would be no more than $100,000 to $120,000. We think it can be done for less. We think that the assessment of each individual lawyer to support this project would be somewhere between $5 and $7 or $8 per person per year. We have not had any negative feedback from any lawyers with respect to the fact that the lawyers will have to pay for this program. But we think the cost is quite reasonable.
How do you anticipate this playing out? For example, say this person investigates a complaint that someone is practicing law and is not a lawyer. Then what happens?
Well, the system that we have developed would provide for authority to issue cease and desist orders if an investigation determines that there is, in fact, a violation of the rule. If the cease and desist order doesn't work, there is authority to work with the circuit courts to obtain an injunction. And again, if that happened, there would have to be another lawyer retained in order to carry on that activity. But our budget, and the one that I mentioned we think is reasonable, would cover that cost.
Okay. Thank you.
Counsel, I looked at your February 16th, 2010 memo to the court, and on the eighth page of your memo, you indicate the following. The court might speculate that an appropriate administrator of the rule might be the state bar itself. This committee has considered the issue and concluded that it is simply not feasible, nor is it a good idea for the state bar to be the administrator of the rule. I note that there are many states where the state bar is the administrator of an unauthorized practice of law enforcement mechanism. Why did you conclude that it's simply not feasible in Wisconsin?
If I can just interrupt, this is under tab 5 towards the middle. It's a letter
from the Sassoon.
Yes.
Well, it may be feasible to use the bar as a vehicle for administering the rule, but we don't think it's a good idea.
Okay. I understand you don't think it's a good idea, but you stated that it's simply not feasible, nor is it a good idea. Then you gave a reason why it's not a good idea, but you never addressed why it's not feasible. So that's why I'm asking.
Oh, okay.
Why is it not feasible?
Well, I guess I have to modify what I said in that memo then. It probably is feasible, but the fact that we concluded it's a bad idea overrides the feasibility of it.
I note in the materials that were supplied some interesting vignettes, if you will, and of course one has already been referenced. That's the billboard in Washera County. Also is a vignette in your tab 3 about, and the heading is, business guilty of UPL in Ohio, now soliciting clients in Wisconsin with impunity. That's apparently an article published January 22, 2010, and it speaks of an Indiana trust mill called United Financial Systems Corporation. Again, this is in our tab for the court's edification, tab 3. I note that the two states referenced, Indiana and Ohio, which have prosecuted or in the process prosecuting this trust mill, allegedly United Financial Systems Corporation, don't have the kind of system that you're advocating here. Don't have a committee that is part of the Supreme Court. I think Indiana right now has, it could be wrong, the most recent information I have about Indiana is that it has a rules petition pending and on the issue of unauthorized practice of law. And I think that in the state of Ohio, according to the ABA survey in 2009 of unlicensed practice of law committees, which is in tab 9 for the court certification, I think Ohio it's not paginated with numbers. In chart 1, Ohio has state bar disciplinary council and state and local bar associations. So it's not totally clear to me who's enforcing in Ohio. So my question is this. You have the resources now to prosecute, don't you? Why do you, or you could bring an injunction now. Someone could bring an injunction. The DA could do something with, if appropriate, with United Financial Systems Corporation. Why do we have to establish an additional administrative arm or modify an administrative arm of the Supreme Court in order to do enforcement for these entities? Why can't the state bar do it?
Well, the state bar has no authority to pursue unauthorized practice of law matters. It isn't authorized to function in that area.
Okay, let's say we pass a rule that defines the unauthorized practice of law, and like many states, like Alabama, like Arizona, I can go through this chart, Alabama, Arizona, California,
Idaho, Illinois, like Maryland, et cetera, like Mississippi,
and have it housed in the state bar?
Well, those states have done it that way, and it may be working well in those particular states. Again, we felt that there was a, as a practical matter and as a policy matter, it was best to divorce the state bar from pursuing those engaged in the unauthorized practice of law, and to deflect issues such as conflict of interest, such as the bar is just trying to fence itself in to benefit its own economic standing. And we think that allowing those issues to develop in the course of dealing with the unauthorized practice of law would detract from the principal objective, which is to protect the consuming public. So we simply don't like that idea.
Well, why don't you set up an independent entity and have the board be perpetuate itself so the state burn is not in charge, that the initial board be made up of members of the bar and members of other professions, such as you name, CPAs, real estate people, bankers. I mean, all these people want to protect the public. They don't want people coming in who are going to do bad things. And it's not only the bar that suffers, but CPAs suffer when people give bad tax advice. Financial investment people suffer when people come in and rip off consumers. So you could have this board. It could hire employees. I think it's not realistic to think one person can do it. And not talk about rent, phone, computer assistance, counsel, investigators, et cetera, and set that up that way. What's the matter with that? Then you'd get everybody joining in, and as the court would say, singing Kimbuya.
Well, we could set it up that way. I don't think that we would favor having a large group of people on an oversight board representing other professions and other service providers. We're talking about regulating the practice of law, the unauthorized practice of law. This court has exclusive jurisdiction to regulate the practice of law and to deal with the unauthorized practice of law. To set up the kind of organization which you just described would clearly be more complicated than what we are proposing. And we would like to keep the administration of this as simple as possible, to keep the costs down, and to have the court be the source of the regulation of the unauthorized practice of law, not a board that consists of various interest groups that function in the state of Wisconsin.
Mr. Zulavy, if the court should agree with your recommendation and establish the kind of regulation that you propose, would the bar be amenable to conducting a 2 or a 3 year study on it to inform the court independently how they think this new regulation is affecting consumers and whether they think it's effective or not effective and so forth?
Yes, I see no problem in doing something like that.
What would your evaluation technique be?
Well, I suppose the evaluation technique would be to consider the number of cases that were referred to the administrator, B, the results of the referrals, whether matters were pursued or not pursued, and how effective negotiation was in terminating objectionable practices, and how often it was necessary to go beyond negotiation and issue cease and desist orders or seek injunctions. And perhaps come up with other ideas as the administrator got involved in evaluating the kind of unauthorized practice of law matters that it looked into, whether publicity through newspaper articles or other vehicles would be effective in making sure the public is aware of the dangers that attend the unauthorized practice of law, so that the danger can be avoided by a knowledgeable consumer.
I assume that the administrator would go out and decide for himself, not wait for a complaint, so that when they saw that the United Financial Systems Corporation, a so-called trust mill, was soliciting in Wisconsin, that they would automatically go out, or he, she would automatically go out and deal with that.
I think that's right, Your Honor. I believe that the administrator would look into what kind of activities are being carried on. I mean, another example where that might come into play is the provision of services through the Internet. That might precipitate also the commencement of some kind of investigation into exactly what the Internet service provider is offering to citizens of the state of Wisconsin.
Sounds to me that it would take one person full time for at least a year.
Well, I think that we don't feel that way. We feel that there's going to be a limited number of cases that will be dealt with, at least in the beginning, and that a half-time person will be adequate to handle the chore.
You did not propose an administrative structure. I mean, that is, set it up with the employee and a budget and various rules that would go forth and et cetera.
We haven't at this time. Okay. But we're prepared to do that.
Thank you.
Counsel, I'm sorry, please. Thank you. Counsel, again, in your February 16th, 2010 memo to the court in our tab 5, in the first paragraph, you indicate four or five times that the reason for this rule is to protect the consuming public. In the last couple of weeks, we had another rules hearing in this room dealing with CCAP and what's on the court website, the Circuit Court Automated Project. And we had a large number of citizens who came and were concerned about privacy issues and how told the court how they were affected by the disclosure of this information being public information in terms of their employment, in terms of their social relationships, in terms of rental, being able to rent units. And I note that, at least from what I've read, whatever you want to do is fine.
No, go ahead.
What I've read, the materials supplied to me, there hasn't been one consumer entity nor one member of the public that's weighed in on this, one non-lawyer member of the public or non-professional, another entity, another profession. What should I make of that your prefatory paragraph emphasizes five times that it's for the interests of the consumer, but no one has appeared on behalf of the consumers other than the bar?
Well, I think other organizations have appeared on behalf of the consumer. I think, for example, the Catholic Charities, based in Milwaukee, has recently written a comprehensive letter describing the unauthorized practice of law problems that pertain to two areas. One, immigration, and two, the so-called notario problem.
And I apologize, because you're absolutely correct. Reference to immigration law and the notario, and I know we have the last time we heard this, there was discussion about legislation regarding the notario situation, primarily right. in Milwaukee. But other than that, other than immigration and notario.
Well, the kind of people who are principally damaged by the activities of one engaged in the unauthorized practice of law are not likely to appear in this court to explain the problem that they faced. We're talking about protecting the consuming public, which is probably not knowledgeable, not vocal, not articulate, and do not hire lawyers to sue the purveyor, do not loudly complain about what happened to them. We collect information. A lot of it comes from lawyers who have talked to their clients who have experienced unauthorized practice of law problems, and then finally go to a lawyer to try to get things straightened out. That's how many of the cases come to our attention. So the fact that the public isn't clamoring in this court to support what we're trying to do doesn't mean that this significant problem isn't very damaging to a large segment of the consuming public.
Justice Prosser.
Mr. Zellovy, President Tamer pointed to this billboard or referenced this billboard. Now, this is about as obvious as it's going to get. What is the problem evidenced by this billboard?
The problem with what?
What is the problem that is revealed by the presence of this billboard and the accompanying material that you submitted to the court?
Well, the problem that's revealed to us by the existence of that billboard is that service providers like that paralegal feel no limitation on representing to the public what they can do. And it appears to those of us who have seen that billboard that the implication of the advertisements is that that person is clearly engaging in activities which we think constitute the practice of law, and that the publication of the services offered via the billboard just demonstrate that how far things have deteriorated with respect to the unauthorized practice of law, and we think the absence of any clear-cut definition of where you draw the line is one of the reasons why those kinds of activities have evolved and persist.
Well, I know this billboard has existed for a long time.
Right.
Who has been victimized by the services provided?
Well, I can't point to any specific human being that engaged the services of that paralegal and received incompetent advice. I don't know the answer to that. Some of the lawyers in that area think that they have situations involving their clients where improper advice and counsel by that paralegal was provided. On the other hand, in fairness to that paralegal, there's a lawyer up there, I believe, who gets referrals from that paralegal who thinks that she's okay. But, you know, regardless of what kind of intelligence that paralegal has and what kind of services she provides, if she is providing services that constitute the practice of law, she's doing it in a way that is not subject to the regulation of this court. The clients are not benefited in any way by the rules of conduct, by the protection of clients with the security fund, protection of clients from the standpoint of the continued education of lawyers. It's out of control, and it's not, in our view, in the public interest that that persists.
Is this paralegal violating the current statute?
75730? I don't know. Could be. But we'll never find out because no district attorney will prosecute.
Well, has the local bar asked for a John Doe?
No, as far as I know, no, the answer is no. I don't believe so.
Well, let's go to tab three, this trust mill, or what is it? Can you identify the injury that has occurred because of these overtures made by this entity that was slapped down in Ohio?
The kind of activities that organizations like that engage in and what harm is done to the consumer?
This one in particular. What can you identify an injury?
Well, that organization that at this point hasn't, to the best of our knowledge, begun any operations in Wisconsin. It did function in Ohio and I think in Indiana. It has been, I believe, booted out of Ohio. But typically the kind of activities that the trust mills engage in are trying to convince naive people about the panacea that revocable trusts might provide with respect to estate planning, and try to sell these trusts as the be-all and end-all for estate planning without taking into account the individual circumstances of the clients and without taking into account often the particular rules and regulations of, let's say, the Internal Revenue Code, the Wisconsin statutes. And people generally, we found, overpay for the kind of trust services that are offered by these companies. And those activities are, in our opinion, detrimental to the interest of the consuming public.
When you decided to define the unauthorized practice of law, did you consider 75730? And was that too broad? Or, you know, because we have a statute where the legislature has defined it.
Did we consider 757.30?
Right.
Sure, we looked at it. And 757.30 doesn't really define the practice of law, which is one of the problems that district attorneys have in enforcing it. It's vague.
Well, it's pretty broad, really.
Well, it is too broad, and that's one of the reasons why district attorneys are reluctant to consider any kind of investigation or prosecution under that particular statute. Furthermore, it's a criminal statute, and we believe that the criminal law is not necessary. Application of the criminal law is not necessary to effectively deal with the unauthorized practice of law, that there needs to be a lower level of law applicable, such as cease and desist and injunctions under the civil system rather than the criminal system.
When I was listening to you talk, I was thinking back about, you know, being a circuit court judge, and sometimes you'd have, for example, someone who was arrested on a domestic abuse sort of battery or something. Then you'd see them the next day, and they'd be in on an injunction in court. And I'd think to myself, okay, this person, if they defend themselves on the injunction, they're basically making statements with respect to a criminal case that's pending, but they're unrepresented. It's a civil matter. They don't have any right to have counsel. So I would try to give them at least a heads up that the statements they make, you know, may be used against them, and that they have a constitutional right. I mean, have you thought about how that might work in this investigative process? I know you say DAs don't charge it, but it is a criminal statute. It's on the books. Mm-hmm. The rule you propose conflicts with the law, or is different than the law. It may be consistent, but it's not the same verbiage. I'm just trying to figure out how those things fit together. And then, that's my first question. Have you thought about?
Well, I think it's, we think that at the present time, if the court sees fit to adopt our proposed rule and establish the system, that 75730 should remain as it is. But we also contemplated that at some point, based on the experience that we developed with the unauthorized practice of law through this civil system, that we would probably come up with a recommendation for the legislature to make some modification to 757.30.
I had a question about tab 2 also on the paralegal. What bothered me is which of these items, and then there's not only the billboard, but then there's something from the Washera Area Chamber of Commerce, which describes these services, two pages. Which of these would be prohibited under the draft? What is she doing that would be prohibited under the draft? She says, you have a legal issue, can't afford expensive attorney fees, do not like to hassle with all the legal work, and want to have someone assist you through the court system, don't hesitate to call me. Disclaimer, I'm not an attorney. Therefore, pursuant to Chapter 20, I can't provide legal advice. As a paralegal, my mission is to empower my customers with legal resources and information to successfully combat a legal issue with my legal assistance. My focus is on affordable access to legal services, which promotes justice and equality in our legal system. This is a self-help document preparation service not staffed by lawyers, and does not give legal advice. This outfit provides quality and professional non-lawyer paralegal form preparation services in the following areas, and then lists where they're going to fill out forms or form preparations. I thought, isn't there an exception in this long list that if you fill out a form, it's okay, it's not practicing law?
Well, I think if a paralegal who engages in the kinds of activities that are described in the advertisement and in the text that accompanies this under tab 2.
Where I am.
You know, if that individual is working under the supervision of a lawyer, I think that, the theory is that the lawyer will oversee and control.
She's not under the supervision of a lawyer. You have to depend on her to send whatever she thinks she can't do to a lawyer.
Well, I think it all will depend on what she does. And
just on what she says she does, filling out these forms. Can she fill out a warranty deed form?
It's conceivable, I suppose, that some of what she does, or maybe much of what she does, would be okay, subject to the problem that I think she has with respect to functioning not under the supervision of a lawyer.
But counsel, your proposal, that is your SCR 23, has SCR 23.02 sub 2, that's on page 2 of our draft, this is draft number 4, under our tab 2. And the proposed rule under sub 2 has exceptions and exclusions. And one of the exceptions and exclusions is I, and it reads as follows. Selection or completion of a legal document, including a legal document created pursuant to statute, administrative rule, or Supreme Court order, where the document may contain various blanks and provisions to be filled in or completed, and selection or completion of the legal document requires only common sense or transaction-specific knowledge regarding the required information and general knowledge of the legal consequences.
Yep.
Now, if this paralegal is only filling out forms, it appears to me there's no requirement that she do that under the guidance or supervision of a lawyer under the proposed revised draft by the state bar.
That's probably right. That's the purpose of the exception. That's right.
So she looks okay. That's the point of my question.
Well, drafting a will can be a little bit more complicated than filling out a form, correct, Mr. Zellerby?
Right.
Well, that may be, except that I can remember, and you can too, because we were practicing law at about the same time, that the law school had a book that McDonald and others put out with form wills that we used.
Right.
I mean, I think I did more than just fill in the blanks, but For many people, filling in the blanks on a simple estate would have been enough. On a complicated estate, it would not have been. But that I does not require that the legal document, it says including a legal document by statute, administrative law. It doesn't say only a document. So that's what bothered me. I mean, I understand the concern, and I understand we got numerous letters from lawyers that said my client came after filling out a trust form from a form trust form that they got from the web or bought, and it was not suitable for Wisconsin, and it was not suitable for an estate of $2 or $3 million, which this person had, and it took us a lot of time, energy, and money to unweave this awful mess. I believe those letters. I believe them. The problem is that you also have the people who are helping consumers who don't have $2 and $3 million estates that can be handled in a more simple fashion. They may be doing it well, they may not be doing it well. But the issue that tab 2 raised for me is I think I could get it under a number of these exceptions. I mean, I don't know what she does, but just what she advertises, I think we could get it under the exceptions.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think just kind of a general response to your points. I mean, the underlying premise of the bar's proposal is that providing legal advice and services requires some kind of specialized knowledge. And licensing by this court and subjecting the person who provides that kind of service to the strictures that this court has imposed on practicing law. And the issue is the competency of the advice and counsel that's provided to the consumer. And when is the consumer better off? We recognize that there are people who can't afford to hire a lawyer. And, I mean, we're clearly not dealing with the pro se issue. We have no intention of trying to deter anybody from helping themselves. But when you have a third party giving advice and counsel, you know, where is society better off? With somebody who is qualified to provide the services, or you slip over into the area where somebody who has, let's say, a modicum of knowledge is then able to be of some help to some people. It's a difficult line to draw.
And I agree with your analysis as set forth there. Raises one other issue. I think one of your definitions of practicing lawyer is under 23.011A, giving advice or counsel to others for fees or other consideration. And someone raised the issue of what if you do it pro bono, that is without a fee? Are you practicing law?
Well, I think that if a non-licensed person wants to, without any compensation, provide legal advice and counsel, I think that person should be subject to the requirements of the rule defining the practice of law and the sanctions that might follow for someone, regardless of whether that person is paid or not.
Yeah, because I think if I went around giving what I would consider legal advice but not charging, I think that the Judicial Commission would get me.
Yeah. That is, I didn't hear the last part.
That I would be subject to the Judicial Commission of practicing law when you're not supposed to as a judge.
Right.
So I have concerns about the fees or other consideration. Any other questions for Mr. Zillevy?
I had one question about the addition of the tribes. One part I understood thoroughly, and the other part, I'm looking at subsection N where it said government agencies, and then you added Indian tribes and their employees carrying out responsibilities provided by law. And I know that the note was that the Indian Tribal Judges Association asserted this would clarify the rights of tribes under the Federal Indian Child Welfare Act. But I didn't really understand how this all went together. I think the tribes can always intervene in those proceedings, but I didn't understand whether it was the bar's intention with putting this in, that the tribes could appear by a member of the tribe who wasn't a lawyer. I just didn't know quite how that fit together. Can you help me with that a little bit?
Okay, well, the recent change that we made to the proposed rule that dealt with the tribal courts was as a result of concerns expressed by the Indian law section of the state bar. Before we made the change, we felt, I mean, first of all, this court and the state bar has no authority to deal with tribal courts. Tribal courts function under federal law. We felt that the general exemption in the proposed rule that pertains to federal law dealt with the problem. However, I think the Indian law section convinced us that they were not unreasonable in asking for a belt and suspenders approach. They wanted further clarification that this rule would not be extended to operating in the tribal courts. Now, when they first talked to us, they said, well, on occasion the tribes will use the state courts. And we made it clear to them that if the state court's involved, that the rule is applicable, that there has to be a licensed lawyer that acts on behalf of a tribe or a member of a tribe. So that we simply wanted to recognize that tribal courts were something different, and we had no control over how the tribal courts function.
Yeah, see, I think for me, I thought what you were talking about was participation in circuit courts or whatever of the state of Wisconsin, and because it says Indian tribes rather than, if it said Indian tribal courts, then I think I would understand better the purpose that I think you were trying to accomplish.
Okay.
So, okay, thank you very much. That was
this
helpful.
Is explained by President Leland Wigninham, president of the Wisconsin Tribal Judges Associations, and on February 22, 2010, he submitted a document which is under tab 7 towards the end. Unfortunately, the documents in our material are not numbered, and he explains that proposed 2302-2N government agencies, you just added Indian tribes there. You just added Indian tribes.
Yeah. Right.
And he says, the inclusion of Indian tribes avoids a potential unintended consequence where the tribes participate in state court cases, especially ICWA and the new WICWA, which is the Wisconsin quote equivalent of the Child Welfare Act. And that under these provisions, tribes have the right to intervene. And that it is not uncommon for tribes, especially the poor tribes, to send their tribal social services director or ICWA director rather than an attorney to represent the tribe's interests. So that this proposal would say government agencies, Indian tribes, and their employees carrying out responsibilities produced by law. So it's the he views it as their responsibilities under law to represent the tribe.
Right.
That's what his, and you don't object to that, I gather.
No.
Okay. That's N. And the other one comes up in, comes in under H, activities which are preempted by federal law, and there you would have a comment that it doesn't apply to tribal courts.
Right. Okay.
So there are two issues on tribes here.
Yes.
And they meet with your approval.
Yes.
Okay. And as I understand it, meet with the tribal approval.
Yes.
Chief, if I may.
Justice Bradley.
I'm returning to Oshera County, to those thrilling days of yesteryear. We visited as a court Oshera County, and I think at that time this billboard was up, if I recall.
Right, and when Justice Wilcox was on the court, Washara was the world. Justice Callow was here, Waukesha was the world.
Right.
Okay, so.
And I look at the materials in addition to the picture of the billboard, and as the chief previously referenced, the materials indicate that this entity is a self-help document preparation service not staffed by lawyers and does not give legal advice. Now, I'm not saying all of that's correct, but I'm saying that's what the materials say. It continues that it provides quality and professional non-lawyer paralegal form preparation services at affordable rates and then sets forth certain areas. One of the comments the chief made made me think of the law of unintended consequences. We also have an issue in this court regarding the certification of paralegals. Mm-hmm. As you may know,
I do, yes.
Yes. And some states, like our neighbor Minnesota, has paralegals who can hang out a shingle and are independent entities, I think. Law of unintended consequences. Will this proposed rule then authorize the establishment of these form preparer entities
around the state, since that's an exception as set forth in the proposed rule?
I don't think so, no. I mean, our committee was not involved directly with the certification of paralegals, but we were knowledgeable about it because it had some relationship to what we were working on. And I think our committee informally favored the certification proposal, although I know that one of the issues in that matter did involve the independent paralegal. Which we would not have been in favor of. Again, it's, you know, how do you best protect the public from incompetent advice or assure as much as you can that the advice they receive is good advice? And, you know, we draw the line and say that paralegals, and we don't know exactly what this paralegal does in Washera County, but the implication is, based on the broad scope of advertising, that it may involve the unauthorized practice of law. We don't know that.
Well, what if we took out the word paralegal, because that has certain implications, and just had the billboard or offices around the state springing up saying, assistance with preparation of legal forms?
Well, then we'd have to have a full-time administrator.
Well,
not after.
I know, but it seems to me that this exception might allow for that. Maybe I'm misreading the exception in the proposed rule, but that one that I referenced earlier under 23.02.2i seems to allow for that. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's the way that I read it. If you take out the word paralegal, which has a which has, you know, implications, and just say legal form preparer assistance, cheap and affordable rates, no legal advice, access to courts, we help you.
Well, we don't think that exception would do that.
Okay.
And hopefully we're right.
Okay.
Mr. Zilvey, I'm curious to know where the 15 to 25 estimated incidents a year number, how that was achieved.
I mentioned earlier that one of our committee members is Jack Zweig, who is present in court this morning. He's a longtime employee as a lawyer in the Department of Regulation and Licensing. He has substantial experience in how that agency functions with other service professions, including the discipline of members of the other service professions. And we felt that his analysis, his extrapolation of experiences of the agencies in that department were relevant to what we contemplate happening if this rule is put in place and an administrator of it is in place. And, you know, it's a guess to a certain extent, but based upon the experience we've had in the last 20 years with the Bar Association being a receptacle for complaints, we feel that somewhere between 15 and 25 a year is what we could expect.
Is there any kind of data compilation in regard to the number of complaints that have come into the bar?
We have accumulated complaints, as I said, for about 20 years. We do have records at the state bar of letters and other communications with the state bar about unauthorized practice of law problems. Our experience is based on, our belief that the number of cases that I've represented are likely to be dealt with by this new administrative body. We think we have a solid basis for saying that. We could be wrong.
So how many complaints have come into the bar over the last 20 years, per year? About?
Probably a couple hundred.
Okay, over the last 20 years.
That I can remember. I mean, some don't get to our committee. Some are dealt with by the staff of the state bar. I mean, we don't have an office in the state bar that accumulates this information. It's kind of an ad hoc operation. There has been.
Thank you.
Any other questions, Mr. Zilovy? You get the great opportunity to conclude later, too.
Okay. Your Honor, I noticed that I'm scheduled to speak on behalf of John McCarthy.
Yes.
I wonder if I could do that now.
You can if you take just less than, just about 5 minutes.
I won't even take 5 minutes.
Okay. Just did Mr. I'm sorry, but I did Mr. McCarthy submit a writing, just so I know. Okay.
No, I want to explain about John McCarthy.
John McCarthy used to be with the
Yes,
Board of
I think you knew him, and I think you knew him,
yes,
based on what John has told me. John is 84 years old. He worked with Phil Haberman at the State Bar, both before and after the integration of the bar. John also worked with Warren Resch, an Assistant Attorney General, on unauthorized practice of law matters. John is in extremely delicate health right now. He is very worried that his point of view will not reach the court. He can't appear at this hearing because of his health. He has been calling me every day for 2 weeks. His wife has called me and said, please don't talk to John about this. She and his doctor think that he can't take the pressure. So I want you to know that John McCarthy has seen a copy of this petition, a copy of the proposed rule. He's seen a copy of the February 16th submission, and he fully endorses what the state bar is doing here, and he believes very strongly that his experience with the state bar in the past is very relevant and enables him to make a solid judgment about the problem of the unauthorized practice and how the bar wants to deal with it.
Thank you. And if you do talk to Mrs. McCarthy or John McCarthy, please send him the court's best wishes and my personal regards, and I'll drop him a note.
Good. I'll do that. He'd appreciate that.
Not a problem. Thank you. And he has that experience that
yes.
you have set forth. Thank you, Mr. Zilovy. I'm going to call on John Knight, Attorney Knight, representing the Wisconsin Bankers Association, Community Bankers, and Wisconsin Credit Union League because of his schedule, Mr. Knight. And you have been a frequent presence here on this issue.
Thank you, Chief Justice, and good morning, other members of the court. I'll be brief. We've commented several times in the past on the proposed rule. We have submitted written materials with respect to this particular hearing. My name is John Knight. I'm with Boardman Law Firm here in Madison and appearing on behalf of the Wisconsin Credit Union League, the Community Bankers of Wisconsin, and the Wisconsin Bankers Association. This may be a historic first, so I wanted to make sure it was noted in the record that all three agree on their position here. Also,
we're glad the court is unifying.
Force. It's been quite an experience in that regard. There have been a number of changes made to this rule over the many months in the last couple of years. These changes have been helpful. We appreciate them. I think it's made the rule more practical, more clear, a little less ambiguous. We still have some concerns about some of the provisions. When looking at the court's last draft, some of the provisions were commented on in the footnotes, indicating some uncertainty regarding provisions. And I thought I would just take a few minutes to comment on those which are still important to us, or to the financial institutions, I should say, And much of that is with respect to exceptions and exclusions. And in particular, the lead-in clause to that section of the rule that says whether or not these are the practice of law, they are excluded or accepted from this rule. We really support, I think very important, the inclusion of the phrase whether or not these are the practice of law. We're concerned that it would be implicit or an assumption that they are without that clause included. We note that the states of Washington and Nebraska, which have been discussed several times here, have a similar clause in their rules. We don't think it concedes anything on the part of the state bar to include that phrase. We think whether there's a dispute or an argument down the road at a later time, whether a particular exception is the practice of law, it can be debated and discussed and heard at that time. But we're very concerned that it leads to an assumption implicit that it is. And we do have litigation that I'm aware of in the states of Michigan and Missouri, for example, regarding financial institutions and completing forms, and that deemed to be the practice of law. So we're a little sensitive to the issue and think that that phrase, whether or not, would be helpful at this point.
Our annotated version, as you know, we approved that bracketed language on 314.08. The bar still objects to it.
Correct.
Just to keep us all on the same page.
Correct.
Okay.
And since they still object, we still wish to comment on it, although I note in their last submission they did not repeat that objection.
Seems to be that, if I remember this correctly, and I wouldn't count on that, that they think it's redundant.
We continue to affirm our support for the inclusion, which was discussed a lot this morning with Mr. Zillevy, that is the exception regarding the selection and completion of legal documents. As you know from our prior testimony, that is something financial institutions do a lot of. That's a huge percentage of their business with the public. Everything is documented, everything is by contract. And we believe that the exclusion as currently drafted is helpful in clarifying and restricts what would used to be an ambiguity or overly broad statement regarding the practice of law. So we would hope that the court would continue to include that exclusion.
The note to that shows that this is subject to further consideration. It was not tentatively approved on 314. And then Justice Butler dissented. He thought this was a major hole in this that allowed others to, in effect, practice law on documents that had a significant effect on people, and that was part of the conversation this morning.
Now, I understand, and there are both sides, the multiple sides of a lot of these issues that you're dealing with here, but in terms of the organizations I'm representing, this is a large part of what they do, and all those forms are prepared by lawyers, but in completing the blanks, of course, lawyers are not engaged by the financial institutions to sit in on that transaction.
Something very simple like a note in a mortgage fall within this.
No, yes. Note mortgage, deposit documents fall within this. That is correct.
How you're going to set up a savings or a checking account in terms of the beneficiary of the accounts, all of that stuff.
Sure, all of that
big significance.
Right, mm-hmm. And those are all form-intensive transactions. And when you go back to the genesis of it, there's a lawyer someplace putting it together.
That's good.
That's good. That's so that continues to be important to us.
Okay.
Another exception, there's an exception currently in the rule, and we appreciate the state bar's efforts to address that. And that is an exception for regulated financial institutions that operate under federal and state law, are examined and regulated by other public agency, governmental agencies.
Now, which is that?
That's the exception.
That are?
That's O2 sub 2 sub T.
T, okay. R is the insurance.
Right.
T, any state or federally chartered financial institution.
Right.
Okay, and the issue here is the bar wants some changes.
Right.
As I understand it, the bar wants to eliminate or affiliate of such an institution. What's your position on that, Council?
We would like to see affiliate included. Financial institutions operate through a lot of affiliated entities today. Whether it be their holding companies or their subsidiaries, they keep subdividing the services they provide. And we don't think the law ought to distinguish between whether you are a financial institution or a subsidiary of a financial institution. You're all regulated by the federal agencies or state agencies. So we'd like to see the word affiliate included. Some prior discussion with the state bar asked whether it ought to be defined, and it's not currently defined. It's used elsewhere in the rule. Affiliate comes up periodically, not necessarily with financial institutions, where it's not defined, where it's used elsewhere in the rule. If a definition were critical, we could certainly come up with one. There are multiple definitions available. But whether the bank or the credit union operate through its own entity or through a subsidiary entity, it might be trust services, it might be loan documentation services. It's just a lot of different variations out there in that theme. And to narrowly restrict this to the financial institution itself would be somewhat difficult to deal with.
Who does the public deal with? Does the public deal with the financial institution? Does it deal with the affiliate or both?
It can deal with both.
Okay.
Yes. And also,
could you give me examples of affiliates? I know you said a holding company, but give me a real life example of what you're talking about when you talk about.
Well,
I'm interested in knowing the scope of affiliates.
Sure, financial institution, for example, might offer investment services through a subsidiary.
Mm-hmm.
It might offer real estate brokerage services through a subsidiary.
Well, let's take an example. Abrahamson Bank. The Abrahamson Bank.
Okay.
What would my affiliate be called if it did brokerage services or investment services?
It might be Abrahamson Inc. or Abrahamson LLC.
But no description of Abrahamson Investment Inc.
It might. Depends what they're trying to market, the name Abrahamson or the service.
And I'd be a wholly owned subsidiary of the bank.
Correct. Correct.
Would somebody dealing with me know that?
Well,
I mean, would I be sitting in the bank, for example?
They could not use the word bank.
No, but where would my office be? Would it be in the bank?
It might be in the bank. Typically, if these services are made available to consumers, federal law requires some separation and some designation of what entity you're dealing with. But it might be in a bank. It might be an office in the bank that the subsidiary has rented, for example.
Well, why should my Abrahamson Investment Inc. get more protection against the practice of law than Bradley Investment Inc., which is not affiliated with a bank?
I think primarily it's based on who regulates you. Bradley Inc. may not be regulated by state and federal agencies. You will be because you are a subsidiary of a bank, and you'll be examined by these agencies. So that's, I think, the premise for this particular exception is the regulation of those entities. And if they're engaged in the unauthorized practice of law, I would expect banking regulators to note that and to be critical of the practice.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
It's my belief that many entities for years have been engaged in what we would call the practice of law, giving advice as to who's the beneficiary of your savings account or checking account. You know, it may be pretty casual, it may not be billed for it, but it's advice, and it's regarding legal matters. So I'm not so sure I'm as confident as you are that if there's the smell of someone practicing law, that it'll be regulated by a bank regulatory authority. I mean, do you know of any that's ever regulated, that's ever cited a bank for practicing law?
No, and the conclusion I draw is therefore
they haven't been. Okay. Well, you have a firm grasp of the reality, I guess.
The other aspect of this rule, the rule says the financial institution, including any employee of it, which is reasonable and, of course, needs to be there. And we at one point had said, or other person, so long as that person's acting for the financial institution. The state bar resisted that, still does. But we note in certain other provisions of this proposed rule, there are references to contractors acting for entities and are included within the scope of the entity. And so therefore we would be comfortable if the court were to say employee or contractor, independent contractor, acting for the financial institution.
That's what the fuss is.
Pardon me?
That's what the issue is then.
Correct.
Employee and independent contractor.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
So if the bank hires somebody as an employee, they'd be covered. They could act, but you might hire an independent contractor.
That's correct. Acting for the financial institution. That sums up the things I wanted to highlight from our written comments submitted to you.
If that's sub S in the bar draft, that's the numbering system, is because we have some additions or they have some deletions.
Oh, okay.
Just calling that to the court's attention.
Okay.
It's not T in the draft. It's T in ours, S in theirs.
Right.
Any questions? Justice Brodsky.
Mr. Knight, I direct your attention to the exceptions and exclusions provision that you mentioned earlier. Do you have the text in front of you?
Sorry?
Do you have the text in front of you?
I do.
Regardless whether they constitute the practice of law, what does that modify?
Well, I can't comment on its placement, but...
Well, that's what I want you to comment on.
Okay. And I think it could be placed elsewhere within that section. I think what's important to us is that the concept be there, that this is not a concession, that these are the practice of law. This isn't an assumption that these are the practice of law. But
aren't those really modifying A, B, C, and all those things, and not at all a license to practice law or active membership in the state bar?
And the following, right, and you could say within any of the following activities in Wisconsin, whether or not they constitute the practice of law.
Where does that introductory phrase come from?
I think we have suggested it, and I don't know whether we suggested its specific placement there. I think others have also suggested this to the court, and initially it probably comes from Washington and Nebraska rules on the unauthorized practice of law.
Well, this is not going to have my support unless it's rewritten.
Unless what?
unless it's rewritten.
Oh.
Is a dangling modifier, it is an embarrassment to craftsmanship.
Right, so therefore we aren't responsible for it.
One thing you don't want to do here is dangle, Mr. Knight.
That's right.
I think we could solve that grammatical problem. It's a grammatically challenged sentence.
Thank you very much. Do you have any other questions for me? Or I appreciate you moving me up.
Thank you, counsel. And on behalf of the court, I do want to thank not only you, but if I forget, to thank all the people who are appearing today, many of whom have appeared in the numerous occasions we've called for a hearing or have written letters or sent emails. So I thank you, but thanks go to everyone in the room and those beyond. I'm going to call on Mike Hageman, who is, as I see it, the only non-lawyer who's registered. So the burden on you representing is to represent all non-lawyers.
Oh, wonderful. I love that.
Thank you. And you don't have to be licensed to practice law to represent them here.
I am, you could say, practicing law without a license, but we don't say that, because I never collect a dime.
Okay.
I had to do this because I ended up getting charged. I only deal with criminal law, and I only deal with 1983s.
You're a specialist.
Ma'am, could you?
You're a specialist.
That's my specialty.
Okay.
I'm hard of hearing because I worked my whole life in construction. A bomb could go off and I'd say, what is it? We have the Constitution. I'm sure most of you have already said you're going to uphold it. I hope. Right of the accused, Section 7, Article 1. In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to be heard by himself and counsel. I do hope you notice it doesn't say by your crooked lawyer next door. I do have a slight bias against those. I've seen, I am going to list the problems I have seen. You also have in civil, I think it's section 21 that basically says the same thing. You, as a person, have the right, even though this is in the mail, himself or herself. There's also a Constitution of the United States, Declaration of Independence, and everything else. It says we are to be governed by the people, for the people, and all of that. That means inclusion. The people are part of it. We don't have kings. We don't have this ivory tower syndrome that quite a few judges have. Everything I've heard so far, especially the first two speakers, were exclusion. You're not allowed to do this. This system and your Constitution says it's an inclusion, and it's included in everything. People are part of the system, and it should stay that way. Do not make more rules that exclude somebody because they didn't go to law school. You would exclude Abraham Lincoln. He was almost successful in life. I was arrested in 2000. I was running for alderman. They didn't like my ideas, for one thing. I got out on bail. They arrested me. Case 2000 CF 1509, on March 23rd of 2000. The initial appearance was 2 days later, within the legal limit. Except it was bail jumping without an underlying crime. The judge said, this whole thing smells. The intake judge. So he said $1,000 bail. Boop, I'll put it out. A DA hold was put on. Anybody here want to tell me what a DA hold is? Beside being illegal, unconstitutional, and criminal. I was held for two more days. And I went before a judge. Her name was Florenza in Milwaukee. She says, I don't have jurisdiction over this case. What does that mean? That means she can't rule on it. At least that's what I've read. So she raised the bail from a smelly $1,000 to $125,000 because she didn't have jurisdiction.
Count, Mr. Hageman.
Okay.
Where are you on this petition? We have a petition for us on licensing.
She didn't have jurisdiction.
I understand that.
Oh.
But we're not here to plead your case.
Okay, no, no. I'm not saying that. What I'm trying to show are the problems where the judges do not allow people to defend themselves. Later, she said, I wasn't allowed, or she would not hear any of my issues, contrary to the Constitution. Now, let's go to somebody else, Pascal Sanders. I was in court, head judge in Milwaukee. He said he's a trained paralegal. He was not allowed to question anybody. He was not allowed to say anything, and the judge was going to put him outside the door if he did.
Well, now we're getting to the issue of this.
Yes, the issue is...
And you think that the trained paralegal should be allowed to represent someone in court. Is that your position?
Absolutely. And we also had certified copies where I was his counsel, he was mine. But that never came into it. But it is endless. Nobody is allowed to say a word in court unless they're a paid lawyer.
Or you represent yourself.
If you represent yourself, you can't talk in court. Aaron Lawrence, case 2007, CF 5913. He stated he will defend himself. They gave him an attorney, wonderful. He says, you're standby counsel. So that's fitting in with Feretta. The judge said, tough. You are not allowed to question anybody. You are not allowed to say anything. And we will not hear any of your issues.
Counsel.
That's a problem. It says the Constitution. We do not need more exclusion. We need more inclusion where people can help. I have never had anybody that I helped that was unhappy. I says, hey, what they did was wrong. Bring this up. Bring this up. Bring this up. Judges normally don't even want to hear it. Even though the case law says it in black and white, they don't listen. Would you please, in your ruling, say, judge, open up the ear. The rights of the accused or the rights in for civil, it says you and your counsel can be heard. That's why you had Bounds versus Smith.
Mr. Hageman.
Yes.
The issue before the court is you or your counsel. And the issue here is who other than a lawyer that is licensed in
right.
Wisconsin can represent someone. And we have a lot of exceptions here that say non-lawyers can represent people.
That's what I'm saying. The Constitution says, and your counsel. It doesn't say lawyer. If I want to help somebody, why can't I help them?
Okay.
I don't lose.
You're reading counsel to me more than or different than licensed lawyer in the Constitution.
Absolutely, because there wasn't even law schools when the people had this right. Anybody could help. You could help out your neighbor. Your neighbor got called for some idiotic thing. You are allowed to say, hey, neighbor, I can help you out. That's what this country was founded on.
I haven't ever looked at that because I've always accepted a licensed lawyer, but maybe we'll have to look at that in the next case. But at the moment, I appreciate your coming and telling us that.
Thank you, Mr. Hackett.
You're back. You're an originalist, a textualist, and an originalist.
Oh, I've been called a lot of things. That's a nice word.
That's meant as a compliment. I say, counsel, you did a very good job. Thank you for coming, Mr. Hagerman. The next person on my list is Attorney Donald Mern. Is Mr. Mern here? Mern? Nope. All right. I've got Paul Sekula marked off. Does Mr. Sekula want to appear? Right. Thank you. And we did get your written statement, and it's in the loose materials that were on the desk this morning. Thank you. Greg Guttermanson from Kenosha. And how badly did I name your name?
Look that up. Hey, please, the court. My name is Greg Guttermanson.
Guttermanson, got it.
And I am a licensed Wisconsin attorney practicing in Kenosha. I've been practicing for 26 years. I'm currently practicing as a sole practitioner, and throughout most of my career, my practice has focused in the transactional area with an emphasis on real estate law. The issue of the unauthorized practice of law is something that I've been concerned about for quite some time. My concerns have been expressed pretty much within a small circle of my colleagues and within my office, generally resulting from frustration when I come back from a closing or I have a personal experience with a particular incident. I have been waiting for a long time for the right forum to present itself, for me to actually be able to address this issue. When I got wind of this through the state bar that this court was finally going to be conducting a hearing on this, I became very excited about that and asked what can I do to help and to share my experiences. And I was told that perhaps writing a letter to the court explaining what I have encountered over the years may be of some help. I have not been an activist on this issue. I have not been involved in the UPL committee. I have not had any involvement with the drafting of the proposed rule. I am simply here not so much to comment on the language as I am to just simply indicate some of the experiences that I have run into over the years and where I think there may be a problem. I'm going to focus primarily on the real estate issue, and where I see the problem come into play most often is in connection with the services being provided by title insurance companies. Title companies are regulated under the Office of the Commissioner of Insurance, and obviously the court can understand that they are authorized to provide a valuable service, that being the issuance of title insurance policies in a real estate transaction. Due to the fact that they issue these policies, they prepare their title insurance commitment, setting forth the condition of title and the exceptions and requirements for insuring title in the name of the purchaser. It's essentially a roadmap to be followed so that clear title can pass and the purchaser can be assured that they're getting what they have bargained for. As such, they also play the role as closing agent. And in somewhere between acting as insurance agent and closing agent comes into play the whole issue of all these requirements and things that need to be taken care of and complied with in order for the transaction to close. That requires production of a number of documents. In most cases, we're dealing with, at the very least, a deed, quite often a mortgage. There are often mortgages that need to be satisfied. There are other potential judgments, liens out there affecting title and so forth. There's essentially a laundry list of things that need to be completed before a transaction can close. And in order to ensure the title, those documents very often need to be completed. What I have run into on a regular basis in my practice in Kenosha is the fact that some title companies blur the line or don't necessarily understand where the line is between being able to provide title insurance services and prepare the documents necessary in order to complete the closing. As I have indicated in my submittal to the court on February 11th, one of the things I see all the time is on a warranty deed where that document can be drafted by law only by a licensed attorney, by a real estate licensed broker who's involved with the particular transaction, or by the grantor, him or herself. However, title companies often will prepare the deed, charge a fee for it, and rather than inserting the name of the title company on the bottom of the deed as the drafter of the document, will insert the name of the grantor as the drafter of the document. That gives the appearance that that deed has been prepared by the seller, when in fact the seller has no idea what is going on, that their name even appears on that document other than as the grantor, and that they are holding themselves out to liability in the event that there's an error on that document. I find title companies also frequently preparing notes and mortgages in regard to transactions. I've had situations where restrictive covenants have been prepared by a title company at the request of the property owner. I've had well agreements, corporate resolutions, mortgage satisfactions, land contracts, terminations of joint tenancies and other probate documents prepared by the title company, as well as the frequent occurrence of escrow agreements being prepared by title insurance companies. In my opinion, these all constitute the practice of law because it's a service being provided for a fee to a third party, which requires some specific knowledge above and beyond that for which these companies are licensed. I believe that that puts the party to the transaction at risk. They are generally charged a fee for the service, and there is no accountability on the part of the title company if something should go wrong. I find that very often consumers will rely on the title company as if it is their attorney. I hear on a regular basis when I'm involved in a transaction and I talk to the other party, I say, who is on the other side of this deal? Who's representing you? Do you have a lawyer involved? And the answer is very often, the title company is representing me in this case. I said, well, what do you mean representing you? Well, they're taking care of everything. Anything that needs to be done, just talk to the title company. They'll take care of everything for you. I have run into instances where there is a developer who will routinely develop properties, sell off lots, does not have a lawyer involved in the matter. The title company handles everything in terms of the restrictive covenants. We've gone back and forth on this transaction where I've objected to the restrictive covenants, and the developer will then go to the owner of the title company and say, hey, the lawyer has a problem with this. What should we do? Title company then says, well, here, let's change it this way. The title company will often take forms from previous transactions and have a clerical employee change the names, change the legal description, use the same general form with some minor changes and say, here, we've taken care of this for you. This is okay. So besides the restrictive covenants, we have, escrow agreements, which essentially is the preparation of a contract between two parties. Again, title companies routinely use these, take these from other transactions.
Counselor, if we were to agree and to pass some type of a rule, whether it's exactly as the bar proposes or something in between, how would you anticipate that we would get the attention of title companies if, in fact, you want them to be more aware that what they're doing may be actually practicing law?
Well, since title insurance companies are regulated, and fall under the jurisdiction of the Commissioner of Insurance, I would assume that any order or rule adopted by this court would certainly come to the attention or be brought to the attention of the Insurance Commissioner. Certainly there are publications within the title insurance industry that are routinely distributed to the licensees, and I would imagine that such a rule would immediately come to the attention of the title insurance industry, who could then inform its licensees that the rule has been adopted, this is what you may do, this is what you may not do.
Okay, so we don't have to send it one by one to each title company, but rather to the agency that OCI recommend, you know, regulates them, to that agency, and then ask for dissemination, or?
I would think that that would be the most effective way of getting the word out. As it stands right now, there's really little that anyone can do to step into this situation to try to prevent it from recurring. It's something that I think is very troubling. It puts the parties at risk. It increases the cost to those consumers who choose to hire their own lawyer, because those of us who become involved on behalf of a particular client, we need to clean up something that is coming to us from a non-lawyer that has some legal deficiencies in it. And what does that do? If we're the only lawyer in the transaction and we're cleaning up somebody else's mess, we have to charge our client more for that service. And it becomes very, very complicated when you're dealing with someone on the other side who is running to the title insurance company saying, well, what about this? What should I do now? And then the document has changed. You come back with a revision, which is still not acceptable. And there's so much back and forth that only causes the fees to increase.
Thank you. Counsel. You did submit a writing, and I have read that. Now, one of the issues that comes to my mind is that there's an exception for the insurance industry, both in the proposed court draft and in the bar draft. And it says, an entity or organization in the business of insurance guarantee or indemnity. Does that cover title insurance companies?
Well, it does to the extent of actually issuing the policy of insurance.
Yeah, but then it says, or the sale of insurance or financial products permitted to be offered by insurance companies or self-insured entity or any employee, blah, 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 when conducting their customary business, which includes but not is not limited to the preparation of releases or settlements agreements. Seems to me that would cover maybe an escrow, maybe a satisfaction of judgment or liens. What I'm getting at is, and that language, the preparation of releases or settlement agreements, is in the state bars too, that which documents exactly don't you want the title insurance company to prepare without lawyers? Now, I should tell you, I'm very sympathetic to your position, having closed many a real estate deal in my practice. So I know what you're talking about. But under this, which of these documents don't you think they can prepare? Which documents, put it positively, which documents or what activities constitute the practice of law in your opinion?
I certainly understand that within the scope of a real estate transaction, there is a need for the title insurance company to do something other than simply just issue the commitment and follow up with the policy.
Or lend you their office to make to deal with the closing, right?
Exactly.
So right. They can do that.
Right. Certainly the preparation of the settlement statement, which requires contributions from both the seller as well as the lender, and to place the entire transaction on a single form, that as well, I believe, within the province of the title company.
Right.
Drafting a deed, I believe, is not simply the way the current statute reads. I believe that's something that should be done either by or under the supervision of a licensed attorney, although in the real world, I know that does not happen all that often. However, I do think that preparing such documents as subdivision restrictions, I think that's out of line, and crosses the crosses into the unauthorized practice, the drafting of well agreements, encroachment agreements, completing probate documents such as terminations of joint tenancies. That, I think, falls outside of the realm of what title insurance companies should be doing. Corporate resolutions. I've seen many times where a title insurance company will call for a resolution either from the buyer to enter into the mortgage or from the seller to authorize the conveyance. I don't think title insurance companies should be drafting those. The same applies in LLCs. I've seen clients or parties come into closings without corporate bylaws and have the title company. Well, here's a set of bylaws that we use in another deal. Here, just we'll change the name and just sign this, and we're good to go on that. So I think those things that are not directly incidental to the issuance of the policy and actually create a document that requires some specific legal knowledge outside of title insurance, I think those are areas where the title insurance company should not delve into.
Thank you. Justice Bradley.
Counsel, do you have any reason to believe that financial institutions are doing this, or realtors are doing this, or other professions are doing any of these things that you are attributing to title insurance companies?
I haven't had any experiences really with financial institutions presenting problems. I think they are much more tuned into their restrictions and the potential ramifications of crossing over that line. So, no, as far as lenders are concerned, I have not. With real estate agents, that gets into a totally different situation because the brokers and salespeople who are out there working hard these days and doing the best they can in this difficult market, they're out there trying to provide a service to their clients and customers. And what they do is once their property has been listed and a buyer has been procured and the property is under contract, I find that agents, as a matter of course, continue to stay involved in the transaction and very often will shepherd their buyer or their seller through the transaction. And that's where we get close to crossing that line again.
Tell me about shepherding. I mean,
well, they are agents by definition, which requires certainly the establishment of a personal relationship, an agency relationship, where the buyer or seller will come to trust the real estate agent as the person who's really in their corner. And they're the one with the knowledge of the transaction. When technically, once the contract has been entered into, the broker's obligations are, pursuant to the listing contract, completed. And they can send...
May I just interpose a question?
Sure.
Thank you. And that is, what I hear you saying is, as they shepherd their clients through this, they may be engaging in the practice of law, but that's benign to you. Am I hearing you right?
I wouldn't say benign, perhaps.
Not as bad as
less egregious.
Less egregious than
let's put it that way. Right. I think the intentions are certainly pure, and I think they are acting more in an agency capacity to try to help a buyer and seller through what is often a very difficult and trying transaction where there's a lot of money at stake. And I don't see a problem with going so far as to say, well, I'll help you. I'll arrange the inspection for you, or I'll put you in contact with a lender. Or
How about if I draft a well agreement?
That, I think, is crossing the line. Mm-hmm. And what's unfortunate is that I think there's a fear out there of lawyers getting involved in real estate transactions. Many brokers and agents, even though they are prohibited from doing so, I hear stories all the time when clients will come to me in a broker-assisted transaction, and I'll say, well, it's nice to see you here, and they will say something like, well, yeah, in spite of the fact that my agent told me I shouldn't hire a lawyer because all they're going to do is get into this deal and screw things up. All they're going to do is nitpick the contract to death, and the whole thing's going to fall apart, so you really don't need to have a lawyer involved in the transaction. And the same thing I'm hearing from the title company. I've had a friend of mine make phone calls to a number of title companies and say, all right, here's the situation. I'm selling my home. This is what I need to do. I threw in a couple of minor glitches, and the question to the title company is, should I hire a lawyer? And the answer is, don't worry. You don't need to get a lawyer involved. We'll take care of everything for you. These are the problems that I think we're experiencing here. And it's just, there are shades of gray here, and that's the problem that I think we're dealing with.
You think this petition reaches the shades of gray or helps reach both the blacks and the whites and the grays?
I think what this petition does is it certainly calls the issue to everyone's attention. And right now, there's no disincentive out there for non-lawyers to stop engaging in the performance of legal services. And I'm not saying that whatever rule that the court may happen to come up with today is going to be the end-all to the problem, but I think we need to start tackling the problem somewhere. And as it stands right now, this goes entirely unchecked. And if a rule were to be put in place, to answer a previous question, I think it would filter down through the community and in the industry that people are getting serious about this. You better watch out, because now there is not only a clear definition of the practice of law, but there's an enforcement mechanism to make sure that if you are engaging in the practice of law, somebody's going to come after you. Because right now, everybody knows that the district attorney's office is not going to do a darn thing. They are understaffed. There are bigger fish to fry, and this activity runs rampant.
Are there any other questions? Justice Prosser.
There is an obvious concern about whether certain people should be permitted to select documents and help fill out documents. But your testimony right in the beginning talked about people who, title insurance companies, who do that but don't disclose that they've been involved in the process. Should there be some disclosure that we should be thinking about?
Well, at the very least, I think that there should be some disclosure and not such deception, specifically with regard to the preparation of a deed, because I really do think that puts the consumer at risk if their name is on a document as being the drafter. How we would get around that, I really don't know, because without a change in the law as to who can actually prepare a deed, I don't see any simple solution to that. I wouldn't see a title company saying, oh, by the way, the law says we can't prepare the deed for you. That's why we're putting your name on it as the drafter. I would assume that they would not want that that seller to know that he or she is being hung out to be exposed to that type of liability. But certainly there is a need, and I'm not questioning here the need for real estate agents to be able to utilize standard approved fill-in-the-blank forms. We could not function in the real estate market without the valuable role being played by brokers and salespeople. And in order for that to work, we do have to have a form that can be used, and we have to have licensing standards so that they have at least a basic modicum of knowledge on contract law and real estate principles. That, I think, is critical, and I'm not challenging that by any means. My concern here is once we get past those pre-approved forms, how far can a real estate licensee or a title insurance company actually go and say, well, this is really incidental to the activity for which I am licensed?
Any other questions? Well, thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you very much for your consideration.
Attorney James M. Brennan, Interim Executive Director for Immigrants Catholic Charities. A reference has already been made to your letter, which the court has regarding immigration.
May it please the court, James M. Brennan, Milwaukee attorney, and currently serving as Executive Director of Catholic Charities of the Archdiocese of Milwaukee. We have, for the past 10 years, had a contained law office within Catholic Charities. That's been committed to the practice of immigration law. With me here today is our director, Barbara Graham, who's an expert in the area and who is available to the court if you have any immigration-related questions. Practice of immigration law itself is a complicated area. I'm the son of an immigrant who arrived here in 1916 during World War I, and he was simply told, come back with an honorable discharge from the United States Army, and you're in. Particularly in the post-9/11 world, immigration law and enforcement has become a far more complicated matter. It's been described by courts as a labyrinth, a place of extreme danger and very difficult to navigate. It's also been described as a place that accelerates the aging of judges who have to apply the immigration law and who have to deal with the thorny issues of enforcement of the immigration law. So it's really unfortunate that this area of great complexity is largely left either to untrained non-lawyers or just left alone entirely. The census estimates 80,000 people in the state of Wisconsin who are undocumented, and we view folks who are undocumented as most immigrants, people who want to get on a pathway to citizenship. That's really what it's all about. Same question that's been asked for the last 150 years is, how can my family remain here and how can I become a citizen? This is a question our attorneys answer every day. Every day, well, 1,000 consultations a year. Catholic Charities has a staff. It's supported by supervised paralegals. It's greatly supported by the pro bono efforts of major law firms in Milwaukee and Marquette Law School. But the problem is that every day we are working to address the problems left behind by the wake of notarios. Immigration law is not just form filling, as was discussed here earlier. The selection of forms and remedies with immigration law is a very technical area. It is also an area where you make an application disclosing a large family history, personal history, employment history. You also, as part of that application, provide fingerprinting, provide a facial scan, and what have you. It's not a user-friendly area in this sense either, because if your application is denied, you are placed on the immediate removal list, complete with all the information you provided, the scan and what have you. So this is an area where there's a lot at stake and there are great consequences for mistaken selection of remedies. Who does this affect? We do family-based immigration. It's not unusual in this state and in this day to have people who have varying statuses within the same family. Commonly have children who are citizens by birth with one parent who might be documented for some purpose and another parent who is not. The consequences of a removal proceeding is directly disrupts an integrated family. That's the primary harm caused by these notarios. We have worked with private bar to, in effect, on a pro bono basis, to sue under consumer protection laws to try and essentially get the message to folks that, you know, at least don't malpractice when you're practicing in an unauthorized way. The problem is very simply this. Our delivery system, our defense, consumer defense in this area covers only 10 counties in the state of Wisconsin. And I would admit and I would suggest that it is a thin line of defense for consumers who have quite a bit at stake. It's also a very thin line of defense for the profession and the practice of law generally. And although you might not see immigration issues as greatly affecting the credibility in the courts, the reality is every day people who are undocumented come through the court systems at all trial levels, most of the time silently and without any particular cause raised by that status. But many of these folks are folks who are developing or who have developed a view of the American legal system that has been tainted. It has been tainted by the notarios who basically committed consumer frauds, who basically committed malpractice in the handling of their own case. So even though we as lawyers, or perhaps you as justices or judges, don't necessarily see this as something that affects the trust and confidence that folks have in the justice system generally, the reality is these are new immigrants' first impressions with our legal system.
Now, there was a statute. There was a statute passed about the notarios. Does that solve it, or at least start
we don't see that. We don't see that as a complete solution to this. I mean, is that a step? Absolutely, that is a step. We do see the need for a variety of protections, including the UPL protection, as all part of really a necessary enforcement system, ultimately to protect the legal system for the benefit of the public as a whole, but also these individuals.
Do you go out after the notarios, except as under the consumer defense law? Do you deal with the notarios under the consumer defense law?
Our staff, they're expert on the immigration law. We handle internally the immigration component of it, and we use pro bono lawyers and others to handle the civil litigation, consumer fraud issues.
How many of them do you get do a year?
We've trained 52 lawyers. We have, I think, 10 or 12 lawsuits pending against, and these, again, these might be small claims case, just raising the question of a malpractice in an area or a consumer fraud in an area. What we do that is response to the notarial problem is each week we get a brand new notarial case which we have to try to solve within the context of the immigration law. Sometimes they're solvable. Unfortunately, many times they're not soluble problems. These are long-term permanent removals and exclusions, sometimes for key members of the families such as the breadwinners. So we at Catholic Charities support this effort, really, to define the practice of law. And we do represent, hopefully we represent, the faces of folks who are actually harmed by certainly the notarial practice. And no doubt there are many other sectors of practice of law where there's some impacts.
But in order to get your, to make maximum use of the lawyers you do have, you must use a large support staff that are non-lawyers.
We do have a large support staff that are non-lawyers, but quite frankly, Judge, we tend to engage law firms that have internally pro bono coordinators in their own support staff. So our approach here is to educate, raise awareness, provide consultation. But really, the organizations we're talking about are Foley and Lardner, Quarles and Brady, Northwestern Mutual Life. And that's where our referral sources are in these areas.
Anything in this, in any of these proposals that would interfere with your getting support staff and help?
I don't see anything in there that does interfere with that.
Just it's all supervised by lawyers from
right,
what I hear.
Right.
Okay. Got it.
Any
questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brennan. Maybe we can take one more before lunch. Hannah Renfro. Ms. Renfro? Representing the Wisconsin Realtors Association.
Good afternoon, Your Honors.
You submitted a writing also, I believe.
Yes, okay. We submitted several, the most recent on February 26, 2010. We are here, my name is Hannah Renfro, I'm with Gottfried & Kahn, and as you stated, we are here today on behalf of the Wisconsin Realtors Association. The realtors have been involved in this rule petition proceeding since its inception in 2003. This is indicative of not only how serious the realtors take this issue, but also means that I will be try to be relatively brief today, because we have been before this court on several occasions, both in writing and in person, and most recently on February 26, 2010, explained the realtors' opposition to the rule petition and also the three amendments that we believe are necessary should the court decide to adopt any form of the proposed rule. Now, I am happy to discuss the specifics of those three amendments, but there really are some broad concerns that relate to all three of the amendments that we have proposed that I would like to address first. The realtors maintain really three core objections to the state bar's rule petition. And those objections can be couched in terms of questions that remain about the proposed rule. Now, the first that has been somewhat addressed already today is the question is, what about this court's decision in Dinger? The state bar has expressed in writing that it does not oppose or it's not seeking to effectively overrule this court's decision in Dinger, but it has at the same time refused or opposed the amendments that we have suggested. Now, it was this court that decided 50 years ago to exempt from the unauthorized practice of law, the practice of real estate licensees, filling in the blanks, completing state-approved forms. This court reasoned that that practice was not only was it not harmful to consumers, but it was actually a valuable tool. They found this court found that to be that practice to be useful to consumers. And that court also noted that the practice had been ongoing at that point for about a century. Now, the rule from Dinger obviously remains today, and that hasn't been contested, but the reasoning rings even truer today, because now that practice has been ongoing for 150 years, there are approximately 100,000 consumer real estate transactions that take place every year in this state. Consumers rely on that practice, and the realtors' amendments seek to enforce that rule and make sure that that rule is upheld in any proposed rule that's adopted. The second question that remains about the state bar's rule petition is, where is the harm? You know, I'm here on behalf of the Realtors Association. With respect to real estate licensees, there is no evidence that there is a significant harm to consumers caused by the unauthorized practice of law by real estate licensees. In fact, what we have heard today and what we know is really quite to the contrary. The state bar has said that at most there'll be 25 prosecutions per year under its proposed rule. 25. And that's of all of the licensees, of all the practices, the practitioners in this state. What we also know is from what the real estate board told this court in its most recent correspondence. And the real estate board, I'm going to quote from its letter, stated that the number of complaints against licensees accused of practicing law is negligible. In fact, the board has seen no recent record of any such complaints. So the state bar talks about a significant problem, but that just there's no evidence to support that.
Counsel, I gather your clients just oppose any rule at all.
We do oppose the rule. There just has not been the evidence to show that a rule is warranted.
All right. But you say then if the court is going to do a rule, you have proposed revisions.
Yes.
All right. And I'm on page 5 of your submission.
Mm-hmm.
On what you suggest. So now we're back to 23.022. And you remove the word regardless from what has been described as a dangling grouping of words, and you put whether or not
yes.
The conduct constitutes the practice of law, because you think sometimes some of those things might be considered by some the practice of law, therefore you want that clear.
Right. And okay. Subsection I of the current, I'm sorry, did I interrupt the
right.
Court? Mm-hmm. Subsection I of the proposed rule lists this, as was discussed earlier, the selection or completion of legal documents And that subsection, this court specifically held in Dinger, that did constitute the practice of law, but when engaged in by real estate licensees for the state-approved real estate transaction forms, it was an authorized practice of law.
Okay. Your second proposed revision is K, right? This is still under 23.022?
Yes, right? And okay. Sub K, yes.
All right. Would you tell us about a bit about that?
Well, we want the additional language added to the end of that subsection so that it would read, the activities that the Supreme Court has determined by rule or by published opinion do not constitute the unauthorized practice of law, and I'm paraphrasing, or which are permitted under a regulatory system established by the Supreme Court. And what we want added is the Wisconsin statutes, the administrative code, or common law. And the reason why this language should be added is to expressly protect the current provisions of the code that regulate real estate licensees. The implementation of this rule should not call into question the current regulations that regulate real estate licensees' practices.
So that that's refers to the statutory and administrative code regulation,
yes,
of the realtors.
Right.
And the common law, which would be the case, Dinger.
Yes. Yes. Yes, Your Honor.
All right. What's third?
The third amendment
third proposal.
That there should not be an enforcement. There should not be duplicative enforcement of this rule. That if this rule is adopted, that we think it's duplicative to begin with, but that there should not be another administrative body that would be created.
Now, there have been several proposals here, and we're going to hear, but in our writings that say any entity or any profession, any group regulated by another regulatory entity should not be subject to any enforcement mechanism we provide. Is that your position?
Yes.
I have thought that somebody had suggested that in language, and I'll have to look and see where that is. Okay. Is there anything else? One, you oppose it in totality. Two, if we're going to adopt it, these are the three prime issues.
No, those are the three amendments that we believe should be adopted.
What was your third broader concern? You got through Dinger, and where's the harm? You are on number three.
Where is the evidence that there will be a benefit of implementing this rule? We have a system that is currently in place, and there's no evidence that system is broken. What we know is under Section 757.30, but in addition to that, the code already prohibits real estate licensees from engaging in the unauthorized practice of law. The Department of Regulation and Licensing regulates licensees, and that conduct is already prohibited. And there's no evidence that that system cannot work.
I want to make sure I understand what you're saying. You're saying that if a real estate agent was engaging in the practice of law, a complaint could be filed with the Department of Regulation and Licensing?
Yes. In fact, we know that those complaints have been filed with the department. And the real estate board, in its letter to this court, has said that there haven't been in recent years. They don't have any records of such complaints being filed, indicating that harm is there. But in previous years, we do know that consumers have registered complaints. There have been very minimal, 11 over a four-year period of time, 2004 to 2007. There were 11 complaints that were filed about the unauthorized practice of law by real estate licensees.
What enforcement, if any, occurred with regard to those?
We don't know. We don't have that information. But they were complaints. We don't know whether those were substantiated instances, but there were 11 complaints out of 460,000 consumer real estate transactions that took place over that same period of time. And it also, during that same period of time, there were a little over 800 complaints filed with the Department of Regulation and Licensing. So consumers do know how to use that process. There weren't complaints filed about the unauthorized practice of law, but consumers are aware that the department exists and that the department can take these complaints and can provide relief.
Anything else?
No, we just want, the realtors would just, you know, like to point out that, you know, the state bar's objective to protect consumers is, it's a laudable objective, and it is one that the realtors absolutely agree with and that we support. An extra layer of, we want to protect consumers just as much as the state bar does, absolutely. But the means that the state bar has chosen to pursue this objective through this proposed rule, there has not been the evidence to show that that would be effective. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. I'm going to read the list that I have and ask that if anyone else wants to appear after lunch, they give their names to the marshal. I have Mary Richards, American Family and Wisconsin Insurance Alliance. Michael Vaughn, Wisconsin Institute of CPAs. Gary Peterson, president of the Wisconsin chapter of the American Planning Association, and David Wearsby, who is a Wisconsin attorney. Just if there are anyone else wants to appear, please give your name to the marshal. That leaves us with 1, 2, 4 people. And then we'll close with Mr. Zillevy. We are in recess, 1:30, adequate for the court. Reappear at 1:30, we are in recess.